All right. I am ready when you are.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 28. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. To say it's been quite a season away from me would be an understatement. But alas, I am thrilled to be back with you again for this new season of life for me and the show for all of us. I've missed you, Defenders. I couldn't be more excited that my first guest back after my little much-needed break is the one and only Chris Coyer. I've been following Chris's work for close to a decade now, and I'd wager you've been following his work too, whether you know it or not, since anything CSS-related you Google will more than likely display his years of hard work at the top of the list. We talk about his brand new book, Practical SVG, Designing for Yourself, and how persistence pays off. I hope you enjoy this great episode with Chris Coyer. This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Picture the ideal state for your business. In a complex and ever-changing digital world, Universal Mind will help you get there through design thinking workshops, UX strategy and design, technology consulting, agile services, and software development. They also believe in supporting user defenders to train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Chris Coyer is the founder of everybody's favorite CSS resource, CSS Tricks, and the author of newly released, a book apart published, Practical SVG. He's a fellow podcaster co-hosting the Shop Talk show. He co-founded the incredibly innovative web coding playground, CodePen. He loves to share his knowledge as an international speaker and avid blogger. His life goal is to be a banjo player in an old-time string band. I love that, Chris. Welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I love the name of this podcast. It's awesome.
Oh, good. Yes.
In fact, you know, we should almost rename UX UD.
Ooh. You heard it here first, folks. I love that. Well, thank you, man. That's flattering. I've been following your work for many years now, and it is truly an honor to have this time with you. I don't take it lightly at all. I thank you for making time for this.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
Right on. So as you know, we're taking a fun superhero theme, and I think it's definitely relevant, like you said. I mean, we are really, we're creating products, but we are really creating them for our users. And we do want to defend them. We want to defend them in the decisions we make with our designs. And So as you know, every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. And I'd like to talk about yours, Chris. And yours is not a tragic beginning. I know that. I know that much. So I'd love to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My past is definitely not tragic. It's just very normal. I just, you know, I live in the United States and in the Midwest with a super normal Midwestern family, and just went to a state school for a normal degree and came out. So I always find it funny when people ask about, you know, like, how'd you get started, man? I'm like, I don't know, just like the white breadest normal possible thing ever. You know, there's nothing to dig into there. You're not going to find anything in my past that's like, oh my God, he was a drummer at a young age. So it's no wonder he's got amazing. I don't know.
Well, you know, what's neat about that is that, I mean, when you look at the superheroes, like, you know, Peter Parker and Clark Kent, I mean, pretty ordinary guys, right? But did some pretty extraordinary things. So I like that tie-in.
Well, I mean, Clark Kent literally came from an alien planet, right?
That's true. He had to try to pretend to be ordinary. That's a good point. Very good point. Okay, just Peter Parker. What do you like to do when you're not working, Chris?
Outside of work. Yeah, well, in the last 3 years or so, I've been trying to, I'm like a pretty overweight dude, and I've been trying to battle that the past 3 years. So that's been a little bit part of my life. I think that's a, you know, and I've, it's been roller coastery.
Sure.
Yeah. Like I think some people can relate to that in some way. Everybody's got some crazy dieting story or whatever. Mine's not that crazy. It's just in the last like 8 months or so, I've been getting into CrossFit. So like almost every day I'm at our CrossFit gym and digging into that. It's been one of the gym things I've really gotten into. I think that's really quite fun. I really would like to be a banjo player in an old time string band. I can kind of play the banjo. I picked it up, you know, a number of years ago. I was in like a bluegrass band in like the college and post college years, and it, you know, if we lose loosely bluegrass, if anybody's like a strong bluegrass fan out there, we faked it essentially, and you know, there were some of us were quite good, me not being one of them. So like the band worked, it just wasn't necessarily strictly bluegrass. And then after that, I was like, you know, I played mandolin mostly in that. I always loved the banjo, and our band never had a banjo. And I ended up buying a cheap banjo and getting into it. And then in the various places I've lived over the years would take lessons and try to get things together and practice and get better. So, you know, I have some banjo skill, but man, would I ever love to retire. Well, someday when I have more time and stuff to kind of retire into music would be just a lovely ending to my life, I think.
Yeah, you know, keep the dream alive, my friend. Yeah. That's a great aspiration. And, you know, I'd love to be a coffee shop owner, but I don't see that to supporting my Brady Bunch-sized family until much later in life. But I think that's a great aspiration. And banjo is not an easy instrument to play either. So I admire you in your tenacity with keeping up with that, as well as your weight loss journey. I commend you, man. I mean, you look wonderful. And I know that's a lot of hard work that comes with that reward. And I'm sure you feel better. More importantly, you feel great, right?
Well, yeah. When the roller coaster is going well, you do, you know.
Sure.
But it's a emotional struggle and a physical struggle, you know.
I hear you. And you know, a lot of it requires routine. I think right now, because I started a morning routine about a year ago, and it's been life changing. I lost about 40 pounds, and because I needed to do some work on that front as well. Yeah. And I mean,
congrats.
I attribute it. Thank you, man. I attribute it to just being consistent, finding that routine, that groove, and sticking with it. But we're in the midst of moving and trying to sell a house and buy one. And
any wrench that gets thrown at you, you're like, oh, I lost it.
Yep. I'm eating cupcakes, a lot of cupcakes now. So, yeah. But just for now. Which is funny because I was just talking to Neri all about how I was able to cut sugars, but I should have caveated that with that's not
except
for now. Yeah, I'll be back. Anyway, that's awesome. You know, tell us your origin story. You don't have to dive too deep if you don't want to, but I want to know what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever evolving field.
I went as far to say I have a very boring white bread background in it was, but I, you know, my parents were cool enough to, and they must have seen that I took to computers at some point, you know, like anytime I saw one or whatever must have been attached to it to the point where, you know, from when I was fairly young, they would buy me a decent computer, you know, and then I was just, my eyes would light up when I got a new one, and just I was very attached to it and spent far too much time on them. So there is something in my body that just from an early age just thought computers were cool. And just kind of rolled with that. So, you know, even through, you know, definitely starting in high school, I would take all the like computer classes that were offered, and I really dug in high school and would take extracurricular stuff and tried to get more people interested in it. And I loved my computer teacher there, and I just thought that was my future for sure. I'd spend all my free time doing computer stuff as well. And then went to college and just was like, duh, this has been predecided for me. Of course I'm going to be a computer science major. Or where I went to college was management computer systems or something. And like didn't lose my love for playing around on computers, but the program I thought was just kind of boring and hard where it shouldn't have been hard and not fun where it should have been fun kind of stuff. You know, it's like just learning languages that weren't clicking with me and stuff. And so in college, I just fell out of it. I was just like, this sucks. I don't want to leave college with a degree in computer science because I have lost the love for it in this way. But I always like continued playing around with them on my own. You know, I did what I liked to do with computers, just not what college had in store for me. And it ended up switching my major to art, getting my BA, and kind of focused on ceramics and some graphic design stuff. So when I left college, I was like, well, I'll still do something in computers. It'll be more like design or something like that. You know, it didn't even cross my mind at the time that web development was a thing or that I was qualified to do that. So when I left, I ended up getting into the printing industry in what's called digital prepress, which is like you're a printer and you get sent files and there's lots of work that need to be done on those files to ready them for the press, which was you know, it's interesting and an art form in its own right. if you're good, if you're really good at prepress, it's a very robust set of skills to make that stuff happen. Not that Absolutely. I was a master of it, but did it for a number of years, you know. Ended up working some crazy shifts doing it and stuff, but kind of knew that, like, I don't want to make a life of this necessarily. Like, I knew while doing it that I wasn't in my final career because I was messing around with making websites and screwing around with that and just was like, yeah, the web seems like where it's at, you know, like this is what I actually want to do. But I didn't know how to, you know, do much for it. And thankfully my mom sells printing. She's in the printing business and just kind of knew a lot of people about town. And there was a little tiny design agency in town, which needed someone quickly. They, you know, they had gotten into it because I think a lot of agencies that did a lot of print work, their customers were like asking them to do their web and digital work as well. And it was like, it was very tempting for a lot of agencies to be like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. Not knowing how to do it. And they had done a bunch of that. They had like agreed to build a bunch of websites. And then their one person who was doing web stuff was like, I'm leaving. And they like needed a really scramble to find somebody who could do web stuff, but also kind of on the cheap because it was a little tiny agency and I think they were minorly successful, but they weren't looking for somebody in the like people are now, like getting paid $120,000 a year to roll into a position like that. They were looking for somebody in like the $30,000 position. And that's who I was at the time. You know, I was just a kid and I was like, I don't know. My mom heard of this job and I rolled in there and said, look, this is a website I built for my band. This is a website I built for myself. I really like it. I can learn on the job. And they just took a chance on me and I did it. And, you know, that was my first job in web and I just like rolled with it, you know, learned as much as I could there. And eventually it got a little old, you know, like a lot of jobs do, and just moved on to other things.
Yeah, that's, you have a quite an extensive background there, Chris. So I definitely identify with the prepress thing. I did that for a little while too. After the .com crisis, I couldn't find any work on the web, and prepress opportunity opened up, and that was really, it was very interesting, so different, but very enlightening. Learning about all the nuances and the struggles it takes to get something from a screen onto a tangible format like a printed
a plate,
a plate, and then transferring that over into a paper, a substrate. It was just, it's so many complexities. And we always hated all the people who sent us their files in Microsoft Publisher. I think that's what it was.
that was the worst one.
Oh yeah. My gosh. It was awful. But
I think, that was part of the magic of being really good at that job was there's plenty of bits because there always isn't any job, but that one was like almost nobody gives you a perfect file. Like your best clients giving you totally press, what they thought were totally press ready PDFs would be like, nah, dude, there's weird spot colors in here. You forgot to pull bleed over here. You know, like that would be the best of it. And the worst of it, it was like, we designed something in Microsoft Word or whatever. And if you're good, the idea would be like, I see exactly what they're going for here. I'm just going to make it happen for them. I'm going to export it as a PDF or whatever. I'll drag some things around if I have to. I'll give them a proof so I'm not like totally making all the decisions for them. But if you're bad at pre-press, which I run into these days, you know, I'm not calling anybody out, but I've, sure. you know, I've had experiences with bad pre-press people. They just won't even look at you. They'll just be like, nope, mm-hmm. don't accept that.
Yeah.
You know, like, you screwed this up, fix it. Like, no, you fix it.
Yeah. You're the, you it's know? Like saying, I'm not even going to try. Yeah. I'm going to try to solve this problem. So yeah, very, very big difference, like with what we're doing now on the web, and you know, it's nothing's permanent really in our work. I think that's one of the big differences between print and also like architecture, where you're building a structure that's going to you know, last for quite a while. Thankfully, in our work on the web, it's very, very dynamic, so we can always be updating and make things better. So very interesting. Who's been the biggest superhero in your work, and why?
God, there's been plenty of influential people, but I think I would shout out to my current co-founders at CodePen.
Is that, right.
CodePen is my biggest. That's my biggest project right now. You know, yeah. with the biggest kind of potential and the biggest you know amount of people working on it and pushing forward that type of thing. So I was lucky to have met, and the guy's name is Tim Sabbat and Alex Vasquez.
Awesome.
We had met in Florida because that, you know, at one point, you know, post that agency job I was talking about, I had found myself in Tampa, Florida working for WooFoo. They had offered me a job and I scrambled to take it because I was such a fan of that app at the time. And it was just a wonderful group of people and working on a wonderful product. It was one of the best moves I ever made in my career was working for them.
Nice.
And Tim and Alex were their first two hires there, and then I was right after it. So they were not founders of WooFoo, but were the first two like tech hires there. And everybody, I'm still friends with literally everybody that worked there. So we were a tight knit group. And then we, you know, the end of WooFoo, not the end of WooFoo because that's still around, but the end of our little chapter there in Florida was selling WooFoo and moving to California. SurveyMonkey bought them. A lot of people have heard of SurveyMonkey for sure. And, so we all went out and worked for SurveyMonkey for a while. So I worked with them at WooFoo. I worked with them at SurveyMonkey. And we just got to be really good friends. In fact, when we made the move out to California, we lived in the same neighborhood because why not? You know, we got to choose. We all were moving together, so why not live there? And that, you know, fostered our friendship even more. And then when we were like, you know, CodePen started out as this little, you know, tiny little weekend project kind of thing before we kind of knew that we decided we loved working on it and with each other and stuff. And, you know, it was a year or two after that when we got to break off from that. And I just, you know, I call them, I don't know if they're, I guess it's fair to call them UX superheroes. They're both very different. We're all three of us are very different in what we do. You know, these days, Tim is very like a server guy and a back end guy and a DevOps guy and works on our Amazon Web Services stuff and just lots of like very stuff that is way over my head in a different world, but still is like very much thinks about the user and is always like, if I come to the table with some idea that's like, this is how it should work because this is how people are going to expect it to work. This is how I would expect it to work as a thing. Tim's always like, fine, yeah, good. That's how it should be, you know? So they're a superhero in that regard, that there's never any pushback when it comes to how things should go. It's not like, well, that sounds harder or, you know, like that there's certainly developers like that out there that are like, oh, I think we should think of this from how easy it would be for me as the developer. And a shout out to Alex too, who's just an all around incredible developer. A lot on our JavaScript side and backend side, but he has DevOps experience well, and is similar in that way. Like, let's do this the right way, kind of thing. To the point where, I would like to think that I was like that, and both of them push me very hard on the like, no, let's really do this right.
Wow.
You know, kind of thing. And they have like a tireless work ethic and a positive attitude and stuff. So I shout out to them for being superheroes of building stuff on the web.
Wow. You'd think they owed you money or something. No, I'm just joking.
Equal parts. Yeah.
No, you know what? I think that's incredible that you, and to me, honestly, like the testimony, the testament to how great these guys are and the superheroes they are and you as well, is that you guys were able to build this incredible product together. I think that's the testament of that. I mean, it's still just such an innovative product to be able to go on, open a web page and be able to type your code in and to see everything happening on the fly. It's just amazing. So shout out to you guys, all three of you guys, as superheroes and building that and providing that to
us. Yeah. And we have such a long way to go. You know, CodePen is just a... When we work on it, it just feels like just a faint shadow of what it can be.
Mm. No,
it's more to come there for sure.
Absolutely. If you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why? I think we know the answer, maybe, based on the intro.
Yeah, it would be so tempting to think, of course I'd be a banjo player, you know, or yes. I'd be involved in music somehow, but... you know what? I know more than my fair share of people who made a go at that and did it, you know, to some degree of success or another. So I think there's a lot of people that are like, you know, had a college band or something and probably went longer than they should have on it. and you know, with pressure from friends and family and relationships or whatever, being like, when are you going to give this up and get a real job?
Right.
You know? Which, you know, some maybe unfair, maybe fair. I don't know, but I knew a lot of people like that that I had a little inkling. I was like, oh, I don't know. Are you going to make it? Are you really going to give this a go? I know you're a music major in college, but it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily stick for it forever. And I was wrong on all counts. Everybody I knew who made a go of music ended up carving a career out of it in their own way. And it's so, it's interesting these days because if... One way to make money in music is to be in a band that makes it, that you sell enough records and play enough shows. But that's rare. That's the hardest way to do it, I would think. And that there's other ways and that you can be involved with music communities and there can be lessons and there can be producing music for TV and film. And there's lots of little smaller ways to make music that aren't mutually exclusive that you can combine together to make a career in music that I see people doing. And that is appealing, I think.
Definitely. And it's not easy. That's why it's neat to hear that you actually know a handful of people that have done okay in music, because it's really, really challenging to make it in music. I mean, it's weird. Like in some ways, I mean, the gatekeepers have all been sort of overcome with, our technologies and things. I mean, you can make a studio ready album on your computer now, on your Mac, which is pretty awesome with the tools we have and that we've been given. But again, the trade off to that is that there's a lot more, of course, saturation.
It's harder to sell.
It's harder to get noticed, but you can get creative, like you said, with getting into doing film, music for film or TV shows, and there's a lot of licensing. I think people might even be doing better at that licensing than getting on a record label nowadays, unless you're doing a lot of touring and selling a lot of merch. I think.
Yeah, but, I'm not sure it would have been for me, you know. So if it came down to, I probably would have been too scared to even try it, you know. I tend to make somewhat safe choices, but so maybe it would have just been some kind of business in some other degrees. The longer I'm in this industry, the more that stuff is fascinating to me. As much as I love web design and development and stuff, I equally enjoy, not that I'm like a cutthroat businessman, but I enjoy thinking about the business of all the stuff that we do and making choices to make that better. That's appealing to me. So maybe in a possible alternate universe second career, I dug into that in some way or a tangential career, you know, like physical product design or something like that.
Well, you know, before November 2062, before your death due to the meteor apocalypse, I think you're going to be okay.
I hope so. That's the thing about tech is like, man, you can really screw up in this industry and then just still get a great job. You know, like if every single thing that I did failed, I could still probably put a portfolio together and get it just because hiring is so, you know, at a fever pitch these days. You know?
Yeah, it's true.
I would think with the experience I have, I could probably easily get a pretty decent other job, or I cross my fingers that I could anyway.
Indeed. So going from some of these success stories, and I do like to talk about failure because I think it's a really great teacher. And in the second segment of this format is to talk about transformation and so life-altering experiences. And, you know, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. And we all know significant transformation can occur through failure, as it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. You know, could you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah, I wish I had a really like obvious one, or I could be like, well, I went to work for this company and it was clearly a super bad choice. You know, I haven't made that many career moves that were clearly a huge failure. You know, not that I've just hopped from success to success, but I've certainly had lots of like side projects that are like, wow, I burned a lot of hours on that one that went that went nowhere. And I would think that the root of some of those things were like not listening to myself more closely. I think there's probably projects that people dig into, or there's probably people listening to this show right now who are working on some project in their heart of hearts, they know it's just not the thing. They know it's just like not, they just don't care about it that much. They can't see themselves working on it for 20 years. You know, they just are like, I guess I'll work on it because it's just what's in front of me right now. And I think that's a failure of sorts, not kind of listening to yourself. I think all that I should have probably went 100% working for myself sooner almost, although that it's tricky because I couldn't like pick a year where I should have done that and didn't. But like, working for myself is a big deal. I know now that like my mind works best in that world. Like I'm motivated the best in that way, and that not too much stress comes from it. I think, you know, I don't know, to some people working for themselves, the idea that stresses them out, and it doesn't stress me out at all. So that may have been a failure. It's not, and not kind of trusting myself to do that sooner. Yeah. And then, you know, I can't even name names, but there's certainly projects that I just spun my wheels on for too long that I didn't care about and wish I had tossed it aside sooner to work on something that I was more passionate about.
Yeah, I think that's really, really encouraging to us. I mean, I think we've all, at some point or another, we've all worked for a Gavin Belson, you know, quote unquote, like the guy from Silicon Valley. He's like the Bill Gates kind of, just way worse, but just kind of the arrogant kind of like, I know it all. Yeah. And you need to just listen to me. And
I've had stories like that. Yeah, where do people like that come from? It's so bizarre to me. Like, what good comes from that? But they're rewarded for it sometimes. Blows
my mind. It's interesting. But yeah, I fully agree. And I think it's a great takeaway for all of us just to really do a gut check of where we're at. And you know, are we spend more time at work than we do at home with our loved ones, you know? And I think it's something to really consider. I mean, I'm not telling people to go and do a Jerry Maguire and just kind of quit their job and write a big essay about it. But I just think it's good to do that gut check and to really see if you're in the best environment and you're being fully utilized and empowered to do what you are made for. So I think that's great. This question is about user testing, and we know that that's a pretty important part of what we do in our work because we want to make sure that what we're doing works and we're you know, defending the users. Do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
I'm almost going to pass on this. I think I can talk about it a little bit, but only because
please don't.
Maybe the super awkward part about user testing is I almost never do it on anything, okay. Which is super bad because nobody thinks that user testing is a bad idea. Nobody thinks talking to their users is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks watching their users do things bad. It's one of the best things you can do. And hopefully the people doing that watching and reporting and stuff are people that can actually affect the product too. I feel like sometimes that type of stuff gets delegated to a weird level in which that the people that got the most out of watching those users then can't really affect what happens to the product. It's like, why did you do the testing at all? You know, definitely seen that before. I've done some like one-off stuff, like one time just for fun I did some eye tracking stuff because that that's kind of requires some special equipment and stuff, and we did it on CSS Tricks, and it was fun and interesting to watch and see how the process goes down. But it's like, I don't know, CSS Tricks is a blog that you read, you know, it's like it's not like there's some pretty established patterns to how that goes down. Like I didn't have a lot of like hypotheses on what should come from that, you know? Can you click the article and read it? Yes. Success, you know?
Where's the mouse cursor? Where's the mouse cursor? How relevant is that now?
You know, so I don't do as much of it as I should, but we're kind of gearing up to do some. I think when a really big feature comes along, it becomes clear. And some people think of user testing as like, okay, I've made this thing. Now I'm going to set some users down in front of it, and I'm going to have my clipboard out and my marker, and I'm going to ask them questions. And I don't know. User testing doesn't necessarily have to be like that. I almost think of customer support as being a little bit like user testing as well. I mean, if somebody sends you an email that says, I was using your product and this is what happened to me, and here's a video of what's happening to me, and I think it should have worked like this. I mean, you didn't exactly ask them for that, but they did it, and that's user testing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we get that all the time. That's like, you know, 60% of customer support at CodePen is that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really fascinating. And again, I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, you can never go wrong with user testing, and I'm a big advocate for it. I think, you know, definitely do it. But I think there's also some interesting sort of things that we don't think about sometimes in the midst of that, where, like, my conversation with Nirial, I got to talk to him recently. He's the author of Hooked, and he made a really fascinating point. It's when you design something for yourself, as a user of the product, you're able to kind of fill a lot of your assumptions in at the time you're building it, because you are kind of the user in some ways. And I think about some of the stuff you've built, and I think about CSS Tricks, and I think about CodePen, of course, and those are things, it seems like, as an entrepreneur that you are, you know, it seems like those are things that you guys kind of built for yourselves. And so maybe the fact that you maybe didn't do all this, testing to a T, was totally forgivable because you are the user in many ways, right? Do you see kind of some of that parallel there?
Yeah.
Okay. What's your design superpower, Chris?
Oh, man. I love this. I actually do have one, I think, although I hasn't been put to the test in long enough. Because I have to challenge myself to it once in a while. But for a long time, what I thought of and what I did was, give me something to design, you know, like a Photoshop file or a JPEG or something, and I'll convert that to a web layout, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I love that. I love recreating things that people, you know, like a design that I found, or it was a part of our workflow at work. You know, a designer built something. Hey, can you build this for me? Mm-hmm. Heck yeah, I can. And not only can I, but I can do it really, really fast, you know? Like, I can process exactly how I would do that and translate it into HTML, CSS, like, in blinding speed. So kind of my superpower, although, you know, I wish it happened more. We don't have like a full-time designer, for example, at CodePen, who's just tossing me designs to build all the time. I wish we did, but we're just not big enough for that right now. So I get to do it sometimes, but I haven't honed those skills in a hot while. So,
well, that's interesting. Well, maybe you'll get some resumes coming your way after that, potentially from the listeners. But I you never know. But I think that's a great superpower, and I kind of envy that. I feel like I had that superpower for a long time, and then just kind of my career path has been more so of the guy that is the designer that just kind of throws the designs over the wall to the developers.
Yeah, not that we should necessarily encourage that, because I know that's not like the coolest thing these days anymore to because that's whatever, that's siloing and whatever. Mm-hmm. Design should be more iterative than that. And I believe all that too. But, working with a designer who tosses you design once in a while, I actually quite enjoy that.
Yeah.
And you know what I don't like, that maybe this is jumping ahead too far or something, but is that kind of when I have to do both of those things isn't when I succeed all that well. It's like, oh, you know what? We really need this like drop-down menu. Like, this is a real one that I really need to think about. And the drop-down menu, like, we have to add a couple of things to it, but it's already a little like busy in there, and there's like some stuff that maybe should be a sub-menu, but menu maybe not. And like, I'm trying to think it all through it. And I feel like it's kind of on me right now, because I'm probably the best person just time-wise and stuff to tackle it, that I need to come up with a design and code it all out.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even require any back-end stuff, but that would be a third thing that needed to happen. But it's like, I know that I need to do both of those things, and that's like tripping me up. Like, if somebody like could design a really nice solution for it and then I could implement it, that would be awesome. Or if I could just design it and then just give it to somebody and they do it, that either one of those would feel better to me than having to do both like Mm-hmm. Just like psychs me out sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I did at MySpace when I worked at MySpace, and that was it was fun. It was fun, but it was really hard. I spent the night there on the couch more than one time because I had to, you know, you're just under a tight deadline. You're doing everything, designing and developing. But I loved it. I really was thriving, and I kind of my gut check has been, you know, I'm missing that. I'm missing out on that a little bit. So I'm gonna start doing a side project. My website hosting, I needed to change it over to somebody else, and so everything's fresh. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand code and design my whole website and not use a CMS. Nice. I'm just going to create a static website. How's that sound?
It's getting hip again.
I'm going to do it. I feel like, yeah, I'm nostalgic. So I'm kind of sometimes miss some of how simple things used to be before we had to worry so much.
I almost think it's weird that we have to think about it like that. Why do you have to feel guilty about doing that? It's the right tool for the job, it's the right tool for the job.
Yeah. Amen. Oh, awesome. So, adversely, Chris, I'd like to ask you, what's your design kryptonite?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe it is that. It's getting psyched out when I have to do much in a silo, like I explained. You know, yeah. Like that bugs me out a little bit. God, there probably is other things that just are like, I don't want to design that, you know. I think it's almost converse to like what I do very much like to design is something that's going to be used like a lot. Like if I know that there's like a really important area of our app, I will rise to the challenge of designing that interaction, where I struggle a little bit with like a page that I know isn't going to be visited all that much, that like it probably should exist because it's like a landing page for some vertical that we think we should hit or something, but like it's just not that important of a page. It's a little harder for me to like sink my teeth into that.
Yeah, like a contact us page. It's funny, it's like one of the most important yet most neglected pages, I think, on a lot of our websites, especially for our companies, I think. So I think that's a great point. So this next question is a fun one, and I always caveat it because I know that you didn't get where you are on your own, and you graciously and humbly, you know, really lifted up your fellow code pen inventors mm-hmm. with my question earlier. So I know you wouldn't say that you got there on your own, but you certainly achieved a great level of success, Chris. And I just want to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be?
What's yours? Have you admitted to it on this podcast?
I don't know yet. I have to think about that.
Yeah, see, that's what it feels like, man. Be on the spot.
Let's maybe turn the tables sometime and you can ask me all these questions. How's that?
Yeah, that would be great, okay. Actually. Bring you over to Shop Talk.
All right.
CSS-Zilla?
Oh,
that's so lame, you know. Most superheroes have lame names though, and my given name Chris is just too Chris. I don't know. CSS is definitely what I'm known for, so some take on that,
yeah,
would be kind of fun. Chris with like extra C's and S's added,
yeah,
to it.
There you go. Something okay. There. There's something there.
Or something that like
Chris SS. Know,
like what was the like folk dude who like slept for too long? Remember Rumpelstiltskin?
Rip Van Winkle.
Rip Van Winkle. Yeah, I like the persistence. Like because he slept for like 100 years or something, right? Because part of what I think about of like success in this industry and stuff is related to. Is to just being at it for a long time. That like a lot of success can come from just. That maybe my superpower is just being persistent in the things that I choose to be in. So like some kind of metaphor for persistence, maybe some kind of like geological term or something we can make into a name. I should have thought about this harder.
No, that's okay. You know, CSS man has not been used yet.
CSS man? That would be real simple, real straightforward. I'll take it.
You'll be the first.
There's just, I hate to claim it because I'm not, you know, there's so many more like old school CSS people out there that probably deserve it more than, but I'm the first to claim it. So
you're the first. And you know what? Every time, and I'll tell you, for years, probably a decade, every time I get stuck and I do a Google search for something CSS related, there you are. There's CSS man. So I think it's perfectly appropriate.
Because it's been around, there's like something like 10,000 pages of stuff on CSS tricks, be it,
yes,
you know, videos and blog posts and snippets and what we call the almanac, which is just like all of the different properties and selectors that happen in CSS. And just, between all that stuff, there really is like thousands and thousands of pages of reference material. Yeah. And that's generally the type of article that we write, is like, let me explain this thing to you. And when you're around long enough and try to have do decent SEO things and have decent web performance and, take care of your domain name and have good uptime and all that stuff, that SEO is just good to you for, like, I probably lucked out to some degree with some of that SEO stuff. You know, CSS is in the domain name. That probably doesn't hurt, but yeah, but SEO is decently good to me, for a small operation. Like, it hasn't turned into like crazy riches or anything, but it's certainly, I get that, like what you just said to me, like, oh, I Google stuff and you're always right there.
Well, you know what? You've earned that, my friend. And I loved your interview in the Made By interview. There's so many good things in there, and I can't believe they got all that within like 7 minutes or something, 7 or 8 minutes. And I'm going to be sure to link to it because I think it's really inspiring. It inspired me a lot.
That was cool.
But I loved what you said at the very end. I think it was your last lines. It was like, how do you become a viral writer, like blog for 8 years? Right?
Yeah, I've said that to a lot of people too, and it's kind of like a cop out, because I understand that not everybody can do that and whatever. But if you're serious, yeah, be persistent about the thing that you're serious about being. And if you laugh at that and can't do it, well, then it's not for you. You cannot just pop into this world and be the number one on Google for anything unless you seriously work at it.
Yep.
Because there's so many people out. I mean, the people just don't understand I'm not ragging on the world, but most of the world doesn't understand how you can be the top result on Google, right? And and if you ask them, if you did some like street survey in Times Square or whatever and said, and ask them what they thought would happen, I don't know, maybe they'd say they pay for it, or I don't know, Google has some magic that they operate or whatever. And how could you be successful at your birdhouse building? Well, do whatever it takes to when you Google birdhouse to come up as the number one thing. There's people that are operating businesses right now that are just like, gosh, the world is unfair. You know, my business would be doing a lot better if I was the number one Google result for birdhouses. Yeah, I agree. It certainly would be, wouldn't it? But that's a long journey to get there. I don't know who's number one for birdhouses right now, but I bet they put in their time.
Yeah, I hope they have a good Twitter presence. It took you 10 years to become an overnight success, right?
Yeah. I'm looking it up right now just to make sure. It's like, just to see how long they've been at it. It looks like the Duncraft, the World Bird Superstore.
Yeah, how long they've been at it.
But they've been building, I don't know.
Since 52?
Yeah, it's going to be something like that. Like, have you been building bird horses for 75 years? Oh, it has. You looked it up. It really is 1952.
No way. I totally
Are you kidding?
That.
Did you guess that?
I completely threw that out of my hat.
The first paragraph of their about page says, in 1952, literally, Duncraft became a pioneer in manufacturing products for a hobby that is now the second largest in America, backyard bird feeding.
Wow.
The second largest hobby in America.
Hello.
I can't believe you guessed 1952.
I totally guessed that.
Blows my mind.
That telepathy man, that could be my UX hero name. Chris, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, I fight for the users. How do you fight for your users?
How do I fight for our users? I think that I do. I think maybe it's not my number one superpower, but we're working on a feature right now on CodePen that's just a monstrosity of a feature, and it's taking us forever to get it out, and that's another story. But when I test it, which is like all the time, that's like maybe my primary role on this project is like, getting it running on my machine and then using it. Mm. And every time I do it, I use it from like, I just want to use it. I don't care how it's built. I don't care what's going on behind the scenes. I want this thing to exist. So I want to use it as if I was a user using it. And so, like, that's putting myself in the shoes of a user, like,
sure.
like totally divorcing myself from the what I know to be true from a business sense and from a back end sense and from the architectural sense of how the app is built or whatever. So when I fight for the users, it's me sitting there just being a user. And even with a CodePen that exists today that everybody uses, I use that every day. It's like it's not this app that, you know, that I built because I thought the world needed it or whatever. It's a build because I need it, which is yet another cliche in startup land. But I use it all the time. So when there's something broken in it, there's a good chance I notice it first, and you know, or whatnot. So I think, you know, when I fight for the users, I fight for myself. I am a user, so I get to do that. And all my QAing and all the Trello cards and GitHub issues I submit and stuff, they're usually from that perspective. Like, look at what I was trying to do that didn't happen the way I thought it should as a user of our thing.
I think that's great. And because people aren't always going to give you the feedback you really need. And if you don't want to use the product, if you're not really the user, then it's going to take a lot longer to kind of realize what's wrong, right? And to be able to know what you need to fix. So the fact that you're actually a user and you're beaten up on it all the time, you're probably one of the first to notice stuff. And then, you know, of course, the first line of defense and fixing it for your users. I think that's awesome.
It's and you know what? It's not, it contributes all over to the product too, because it's not just let's make sure that we're building the right thing. Let's make sure that we're fixing bugs when they're break and stuff. But it's like, if you actually use it, then you can be like, oh, I use this little nook and cranny of the feature, you know, because I'm a user. Like, you know what? That would actually make like kind of a good tweet because, because it just occurred to me that it was kind of neat and useful thing that I just used, and it just kind of reminds you of that. So it kind of turns into marketing. Or there's like, you know what, I actually like was using our product and pulled off something kind of interesting, or I built, you know, because CodePen is for building stuff.
Yes.
I built this thing and this is how I did it. So it ends up turning into a blog post. Being a user of your project is just immensely useful.
It's, great takeaway.
You can do really good support because you use it all the time. So you can, because I do it, I can be like, oh yeah, I'll show you how to do that. I do that all the time. Let me write it up for you. I can update our docs because I can be like, you know what? That was a little weird. I'm not sure that it warrants like changing the product, but it does possibly represent documenting a little better. You know?
Oh, such a great takeaway, Chris. And you know, I think we can start a hashtag of I might be the user. What do you think?
Yeah, pretty good. I am the user.
I am the user. Awesome. So, you know, we think a lot about the future. I think that's just natural being in this field because stuff always changes. And I mean, we can't get too comfortable, and it's hard to have the curse of knowledge in this field. And I think you'd be the first to admit it with as much as you know. I mean, there's always something more to learn. So I know that we're constantly thinking about that, but I'm curious, your thoughts of the future. What does the future of UX look like to you, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it helps to like define UX first, and I don't even want to do that because that's such a weird, convoluted place to go.
Sure.
But from the most broad possible thing, it's like my favorite field that exists because it, you know, it's just, you know, like we very started with, it's like we should almost change the name to UD because it's like your job is to make sure that the thing that you're employed by does right by the users, that it's understandable, that it is solving their needs, that it's, you know, that it communicates well and all that stuff. And those lessons are, you know, I'm sure it's no surprise to anybody here, go way past websites.
Yeah.
You know, that your UX is everything. It's like, if you have a phone line, it's for that. If you, you know, if you make a brochure for your thing, it's that. If you sell a physical product, it's the box that it comes in. It's the social media presence. It's the what you wear to the trade show. I don't know. It's just everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what's cool about that is if you're really good at it, and right now you work at Facebook or something doing it, or if you work at a web design agency, or you work for us at CodePen or something, in your title as UX, and that's what you are actually charged to do, is like represent the users and do that. Like, I don't even know what that job looks like these days, because I unfortunately don't work with them as much as I should or whatever. So it's like a little weird to talk to about this. But I would think if you're very good at that, which certainly there's lots of people out there that are, that the future of your job is to just keep doing that job anywhere that needs you. Hmm. It could be, you know, like I wouldn't doubt that both of us live to an age in which the websites are just not like what they were, you know. Hmm. Like maybe that's sad or whatever, but
yeah.
I would think that but there'll be something else. There'll sure. be some other product, there'll be some other service, hmm. and you'll just be useful forever, because what you've developed is this skill set that's like, that puts yourself in those shoes, that has empathy, that can communicate ideas on both sides. You can talk to users and you can translate that into talking to the builders of the product. And like that skill set is more transferable than like most other skill sets.
Hmm.
So the future is bright for you, I would think.
Yeah, I would agree with you, I really like your answer a lot, Chris. And I think it's just thinking about the users to start with, right? To start and to finish with, because I think that user experience extends far beyond our screens. And I think that's kind of, as designers, as you know, quote unquote UX designers, I think that's kind of where our heads are mostly wrapped around right now is how do we get our content on a screen? But I think that there's going to be a lot of things changing where we have to start thinking about. You know, what is that holistically, you know, beyond the screen, and how does that integrate with their home and with their car and all the things, right, that are sort of interconnecting all of a sudden and all the time, it seems like. Let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Oh, my favorite one that we've already probably talked about a number of times is the persistence one. Mm. And that I just can't impart that to people enough. And that maybe the extension of it isn't, it can be just as simple as, you know, if you really care about succeeding in something, you just need to do it for a long time. You just got to put the hours in. You just got to show up and do the job, and you'll get there. You just will. It just always works. It's the number one way to success in something. And it's both empowering and kind of a bummer sometimes, because people are like, oh, I'm no good at snowboarding or whatever. Like, well, have you put in like a ton of hours on it? You just got to know. Like, there's no thing that you can just pick up and just be good at. It's like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know. So once you've kind of have wrapped your head around that, you kind of got to pick and choose in your life what things you're going to give time to and what's not. And like this one's even sad for me, but I love music so much, and I've just had to come to the conclusion that it's like I'm going to piddle around with it and hopefully keep my skills up, but I'm not ever going to be real, real good until other things in my life I have to cut out in which to give to that. Because that will be the moment that I can really level up in it properly and give it the hours that it needs. So yeah, persistence is such a big deal, and it just unlocks all the doors for you. And if you're having trouble being persistent on a thing, then it's the wrong thing to be persistent with. Like, if you can't give the thing that needs persistence, there's just something wrong. It's just wasn't meant to be, you know?
Yeah.
Persistence should be both challenging and come easy in a way.
Hmm. Fascinating. Yeah. Because you're enjoying that, right? That what you're persisting on. You're
enjoying
there's
like
that.
There's no question about it. Like, of course I'm going to wake up and work on that thing because that's the thing.
Love it. Yeah. I'm getting a theme from this, from our time. And I think it's a really, really good one. It's about practice. And if you really enjoy what you're doing, it's not going to feel as much like work, even though it is. And even though you are persisting at something, even though you're maybe staying up till 3 a.m. trying to solve a problem, it doesn't feel like it because it's something that you really are passionate about. So keep practicing. You'll get better.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite things that I was just, it looks like it was about 1 year ago. I can't believe how the years fly by, but it's a blog article that I wrote that like nobody read because it wasn't about CSS, you know. But it's called the snowballing of practice.
Oh, wow.
And it's just a phenomenon that I noticed that, like, let's say I really want to get good at being a banjo player, that I can't practice 12 hours a day to get better. And it's not because I don't have those hours. Let's say I did have those hours. Like, there's just not enough for me to do during those hours. Like, my fingers would get tired. I can't keep my, mentally, I would exhaust on the songs that I knew and was able to practice. And, like, you can't, but somebody who's already really good at banjo, say, or baking muffins or whatever, they can practice longer.
Building birdhouses.
And the time that they spend is more. Sure, birdhouses. Somebody who's like build lots of birdhouses, they can build birdhouses for 12 hours and still like get something out of it. They can see how it connects to other birdhouses. They can have ideas that they're storing away for future birdhouses they want to build, and they just like have more stamina for practice.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by the snowballing in practice. So it's like you have to practice a lot in which to get good at practicing.
Yes.
It's weird.
Oh, man, that's awesome. I'm going to make sure I link to that article, Chris. Okay. And then we'll get maybe two more views on that. Me and one other person.
Yeah.
That's what happens when I write stuff on Medium. It seems like everyone's on Medium. Yeah. I'll write something, and there's like two people that read it.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. I love to write, so I'll do it anyway. So, Chris, you know, how do you stay inspired? Because there's so much changing. There's so much, you know, how do you stay inspired to persist?
Well, jealousy is, is one, you know. I noticed not so long ago. I feel like sometimes in our, you know, speaking of Medium, not that I have anything against Medium, I don't. But sometimes people are like, you know, how I stay inspired? I like, you know, I take 2 months off and climb a mountain and look at flower petals, and then I come back and I understand something more than I did. It's like, no, what you did, dude, is you took a vacation and then you came back and you felt good because you came back from a vacation. And you know who takes vacations? Everybody, since they invented jobs, you know. It's like, not like, don't overcomplicate it, you know. Like, yeah. Go to Disney World. You'll come back. You're going to feel great. I promise, you know. So I feel like, are you a little burnt out? Take a vacation like everybody else on Earth does when they're, you know. Not that you can't have thoughts about vacationing, whatever, you can, but, you know, I feel like I've read enough times on articles on burnout and all these fancy things. Like, those are real topics, but, like, just don't underestimate a good old vacation.
Yeah, yeah, fully agree. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
You'd have to tell me stuff like that. I'm sure I should subscribe to the bi-weekly
Bugle.
Newsletter here. Bugle. Let's bugle it.
Yes.
I don't get a good one. Is there because you know what I do subscribe to is a bunch of newsletters for me, as like, you know, like a CSS newsletter and a JavaScript newsletter and a responsive web design newsletter and things like that. And I really like those because they just blast you with like 10 links that you're like, oh, maybe I saw a couple of these. Maybe a couple of these are like, look totally irrelevant to me. And oh, here's one that I looks awesome. And then, so I like getting those, but I don't get one that's specifically for UX. Are there a couple?
You know, it's funny because there are a few, I mean, but everything, there's a lot of piecemeal too. It just depends, I think, on what you're looking for. Again, because there's a lot of noise. You just have to find something that resonates with you. So what I do in my newsletter is I simply open up with a personal greeting, and then I announce the next super guest is how I do it. And I have a friend, an artist that creates renderings of my guests kind of in a superhero sort of comic fashion, which is a lot of fun. And then I'll just, I have like a couple of resources occasionally, but typically I'll go right into just a little blog, kind of like a Seth Godin kind of typically sized little blog thing I do. Yeah, I still
read RSS, and he's still one of them that's in there because he's just so ridiculously prolific at stuff.
Oh my
gosh. And I've definitely met people that are just like, I don't know, he just seems to write things that are common sense. And I'm like, yeah, kind of, but I don't know. The longer you read it, the more interesting it gets almost.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Don't Make Me Think book that Steve Krug, I mean, it's still one of the greatest UX books, I think, arguably. And it's really everything he put in there is simply common sense for the most part.
Right.
But I think sometimes we need to be reminded of it, I think.
That's a good one. What's that other classic one with the tea kettle and stuff?
The Design of Everyday Things.
Of Everyday
Norman.
Things.
Norman.
Yeah.
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 That's a great one. Well, I want to talk about practical SVG right now, just for a few moments that we might have left here, because I think it's an incredible book, and it's a super useful resource, especially for designers who are pretty unfamiliar with SVG and what it can do. And so I do want to highly recommend that book to our defenders, and also our great friends at A Book Apart are offering 15% off, which is awesome. Yes. So that's pretty incredible. And so thankful for that. And so I'm going to make sure that I put that in the show notes. But I just want to, you know, just real quick, can you tell us just what is SVG and why is it important for designers to know it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the book is, like you said, practical SVG. It's not like SVG for artists, or, you know, there's lots of like ways that you can use SVG, because all it is a vector graphics format, you know? So it could be absolutely anything that you design in a vector format. Like it's a native format of Illustrator. Anything Adobe Illustrator can do can be saved as a SVG file, for example, you know? The book is specifically for, like, you know, people who make websites, like front end developers who like think they should probably be using SVG but aren't reaching for it as often as I'd like, that haven't developed like the muscle memory of like, oh, that thing should probably be SVG. Thinking of a good example here, let's say you went to userdefenders.com.
All right.
And there's a beautiful banner that said User Defenders with a big long drop shadow thing behind it. Like, that's just a beautiful use case for SVG.
I like the sound of this.
It's just, I can just kind of tell by looking at it that it's like a JPEG it looks like a JPEG with some of the minor artifacting you can see, which is good because it means you like optimize the crap out of it and stuff, because it's a big hero image and stuff. But you can tell that it was designed vector.
Yeah,
you know, those are vector lines, and the chances of that being a really kind of small, efficient SVG file, just a hot tip here, that would be an excellent choice for SVG on a website. And that's the kind of thing I'd like to tell more people. Like, when you see something like that, your muscle memory for reaching for SVG should be there, because there's just a lot of advantages to it. For example, if this was SVG, the file size would probably be a little bit smaller. Maybe it'd be comparable, but I bet it would be smaller. You would have control over it in an interesting CSS kind of way. So maybe you'd like the yellow color of it, but maybe you could have a hover color, and so you know, user and defenders could change color when you hover over it. You have that kind of control in SVG where you don't with a regular image, you know, a CSS background image or an image tag in HTML. You just don't have as much control that way. And different things you control too, like you have different kind of control over the strokes and stuff that you don't over regular div images. You could add different kinds of interactivity. It could be animated. You know, there's a lot of movement to this logo, so it could, like, maybe those drops, you know, the user defenders could go what and come towards you. You know, like, that kind of thing is not particularly difficult in animating SVG. So it's like, not only would the file size be smaller, it would look crisper. You could still have it be web text, which would be kind of amazing. So it'd be like almost more accessible in a way. And there's more design possibilities because it could be animated and all that stuff. So I want people to like know that and be like, reach for SVG instead. And this book is all about that. It covers all of that stuff.
Oh, man. I love how you describe that. And I also selfishly love how you use my website as an example. I mean, that's just awesome. And I'm inspired, man. I tell you, I'm telling you the truth. I am so inspired to really take this and run with it. And you've given me and anybody who reads it the tools to be able to do that. So thanks for writing this book, Chris. Highly recommend it. Defenders, pick up Practical SVG. We'll put a link in the show notes, and also a special Defenders discount of 15% off. So, Chris, what's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes? You've given a lot already. I mean, the persistence thing, the practice thing. I mean, that's enough
putting
already.
Yourself in the shoes of the user, and, you know, having some empathy towards the people that use your site, all of that's becoming an overused word too. I like that word, so I'm going to continue to use it. I'm sure you've heard on this show the empathy being used a bunch of times, but in a sense, it's just like, you know, feeling for the people that use your thing.
Yes.
And really actually feeling, not just be like, you know, oh, this person is just an alternate version of me, so I'm going to make sure that this thing works for me. I mean, I'm guilty of that in a big way, but thinking of, you know, not just alternate versions of you, the people that come from a very different place. So
yeah.
I don't know, you'd probably have better advice, you know, reading your newsletter probably has better advice than I could give in this world. Cause I'm not really, absolute UX person. I just like the word and like thinking about, you know, defending users and stuff. But I'm sure that there's I think there's like an official profession of UX, right? That I just don't know enough about. So I'd hate to guide anybody that way. I'd be like, you know what? You know what'd be interesting is like if you're really interested in UX, can't you find somebody to like shadow that can like show you the ropes of what they do? I think that would be like really. That would be like good advice. Like,
yeah.
Are you interested in a career like this? Watch somebody who's good at it do it.
Mm, absolutely. And I appreciate you mentioning empathy too, because even though it's a word that's used a lot, and I think it's such an important one, and to truly feel what people are going through as they use your product and feeling about, you know, some of the pain points that they have and feeling that pain and doing something about it. I love it. And it never gets old to me, honestly. So the empathy is a great one. I started thinking about, you know, UX is such a buzz, it's such a catchword and such a buzz phrase. And I think it's just the easiest way to try to explain what we do because there's so many.
Yeah, it's just a really good word right now.
Yeah.
So it's like almost a reason that it's played out.
Yeah.
Isn't there let's see, because we were talking about practice as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fairly new book out. It looks like Indy Young is the author, called
Yes.
Practical Empathy. So
Yes.
Speaking of practical SVG. So
yes.
It's a thing that you can practice as well. You know, if you're like, if you think you should have better empathy, which, you know, it's kind of that's weird. I wonder if it's addressed in the book. I haven't actually dug into it yet, although I did buy it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't have the book yet, but I'm.
Does anybody think they have bad empathy? I think that's one of those things that like, nobody thinks they're a jerk.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I think that's where humility comes in our profession. I mean, because there's a lot of designers, and I've worked with a few that seem to like they have all the answers. Like they know exactly what to do all the time, and they're not teachable. And I think maybe there's a level of lack of empathy, because if they truly knew what people were going through that were using what they're designing, they might have a different perspective, I think. But yeah, I definitely want to read that book by Indy.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and maybe Indy, if you're listening, I'd love to talk to you about it too sometime. Because that's a near and dear to my heart, honestly. And I started thinking about like our titles, you know, UX, and you know, you were saying UD, which I this super flattered by. I think that's awesome, UD. And I started thinking, well, maybe we could be empathy designers, you know. But then I don't know if I want to call myself an ED designer, you know. ED is not a great acronym for men.
Yeah, that's
for
probably
men.
Why UX is just everywhere. It's just like it's kind of like a cool two letters, and
yeah,
makes sense. And
indeed. So, Chris, as we come to a close here, can you tell us about one thing you're working on you're most excited about?
Well, I can't really.
Okay.
Only because, well, I mean, I don't know. I have ideas. There's another book I'd like to write. There's this major new feature at CodePen, but it's, you know, it's just standing in line with lots of features at CodePen that we want to do. And just for like, it's not even for like competitive advantage or anything at CodePen, because I'm just not the kind of guy that cares about that all that much. You know, we try to work on things that just are good and ignore that for the most part. But it's just that if you talk about it too much, like I already regret some of the people I've already told about it and presented it to, because I'm like, now we've like shown you and promised you this thing, and now it's taking us a little longer than expected, and it just builds up kind of some weird feelings, you
know? Sure.
Rather just like not, it's more fun if you just are like, here's the thing! instead of talking about it forever. I mean, how many times has that gone wrong?
No, I totally respect that. I totally do. Because I think we can kind of get a little loud sometimes. I mean, I don't know about you, but it sounds like not you, but sometimes I have a tendency to just like want to start talking about stuff before it's even happened.
Oh, I have that so bad. So bad. You know, like it's hard for me to even like wait on an article for somebody to proofread it, because I'm like, I'm done writing it, hit publish.
Right. Yes.
So that's hard for me, and it's just as hard with this feature too. But yeah, you know, stay tuned to CodePen for all of you that are web designers out there who enjoy CodePen. And it's I won't even give you the elevator pitch, because it's hard to give, because it's such a weird place that people use for lots of different things. But there's just a ton of work on CodePen. That's one thing that exists. Is there's millions and millions of pens that people have created, which are just combinations of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to do something you know, interesting. And there's a ton of it there. And so if you're interested in that builder spirit, that's what CodePen is there for. And more coming.
Awesome. And that's a great hook. And I think that that's a great segue into my last question for you is just, can you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Yeah, well, I use my name everywhere, you know. So Chris Coyer is my name, and I have a website that's, you know, in the grand spirit of personal websites, not updated all that often, but is kind of the portal to the other things that I do, chriscoyer.net. But I'm Chris Coyer on GitHub. I'm Chris Coyer on Facebook and Twitter and Elo and just anything that you can have a username on. I'm Chris Coyer on, and I wouldn't mind talking to you at chriscoyer@gmail.com. Anything that is my name, I'm very easy to find on the internet.
Well, Chris, this is from the heart. You really are a shepherd in our field, and you are just such an incredible contributor, and you've dedicated so much of your time and energy to help us, to help others, and to just bring our field forward. So I want to thank you sincerely for that, and thanks for being here today. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
I swear I did not Google the birdhouse maker's year of origin. That was a complete happy accident. Chris is a true superhero, and we owe a debt of gratitude to him for all he's done for us and our field. I had such a blast talking with him, and I cannot wait to start using SVG way more in my designs, and hopefully even on the User Defenders logo here in the near future. I loved how he referenced that. As mentioned, Chris shows us the way to harness the power of SVG in his brand new book, Practical SVG. Our friends at A Book Apart are offering an exclusive Defenders discount of 15% using coupon code SUPERSVG at checkout. I've put a link in the show notes that'll teleport you right over. Be sure to act fast because this great offer expires December 31st. I also want to encourage you, if you haven't already, to subscribe to the Biweekly Bugle, where you'll get personal notes from me along with super guest announcements and my usable thoughts that eventually, if they're good enough, turn into published articles. Thanks for hanging in there, Defenders, as I pull through my life stuff. I'm happy to report we are moved into the new house that looks like something from Hoarders as we now try to find stuff in all those mystery boxes. If you ever need help or tips on moving, please don't hesitate to ask. Don't ask me to help you move because I'm done with that for for a while. But if you need tips, don't hesitate to ask. I have learned a few things. I want to wish you all who celebrated a happy Thanksgiving, and I look forward to being back with you with a brand new episode in 2 weeks with architect turned UX designer Ling Lim. I want to thank Chris Combs for the superhuman editing and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.